Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, Episode 11, for March 31st, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This is a bit of a special edition of the Brainy Gamer podcast because the lion's share of it will be devoted to an interview that I conducted yesterday with Lee Alexander, one of my great blogger heroes, and I talk about that in the interview with her. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you know that I've been conducting interviews with people that I admire and respect who are bloggers writing about games, journalists. I'm trying to get in touch with people that I think you'd like to hear more about and talk to them about their work. And in this case, I spent more time with Lee than I originally intended. She was gracious enough to talk to me for a nice bit of time. And so the interview is a little longer than the previous ones I've done. And rather than try to, kind of chop it down into a 15-minute segment, which is what they typically are, I decided I would go ahead and let it be what it is, which is a chat about how she got started and where she's from, a bit of background before she ever became a blogger, what she learned early in her life about video games, and she says some interesting things about that. But I get a lot of questions from people who are interested in blogging and who have an idea for a blog. It may not even be a video games related one. Or who are interested in podcasting, that sort of thing. I think Lee is a good person to talk to about how to go from a person who's real curious and real more than curious, has an avid interest in video games on a serious level. How do you take that interest and turn it into something that, enables her to devote herself to it on a daily basis? And in her case, unlike me, she's making a living at it. So she's fascinating, and she was, for quite some time, really, my idea of the kind of blog I wanted to have, which is to say, she writes on a regular basis, basically daily. She tends to focus in a rather, intellectually curious and rigorous way on video games, and she's developed a community around her blog of people who have a similar avid interest in video games. And so, when I thought about starting The Brainy Gamer, I thought her blog, Sexy Video Game Land, was really kind of my cup of tea. And as I mentioned to her in the interview, she was very kind to me early on in linking to a couple of my posts and kind of throwing some credibility my way when I was trying to get people to discover that I existed. And so I've been grateful to her for some time, and we've chatted a little bit before and had a little correspondence, and I was hoping she would say yes to this interview, and she said yes right away and was pleased to do it, and so I'm happy to bring it to you. Now, I'll say this. She did tell me a pretty choice little bit of news, which is very exciting about her future, and she's going to talk about that on her blog in about a week, I think. So she'll mention it briefly in the interview, but keep your eye on her blog, sexyvideogameland.blogspot.com. I'll link to it in my show notes. And you'll be very curious, I think, to find out what she's going to be doing next, which is really cool. So that's the main part of the podcast, the interview with Lee. Now, I do have a few other things I want to do on the podcast. Before I get to the interview, I want to talk about a couple of games I've been playing recently. I wanted a couple of shout-outs to some bloggers that I think you might like to know about. I want to talk about the big experience that occurred to me in between my last podcast and now. And I want to get to a question that came up for the last podcast that I wasn't able to answer. I'll get to that in this next segment. So away we go. This has been a really fun couple of weeks for me for a variety of reasons, not the least of which I've been playing the Zelda games pretty much nonstop. I got it into my head that I wanted to do a series on the future of the Legend of Zelda franchise. And I finished that series a few days back on the blog. And it meant that, you know, I kind of had to dive headfirst into some of the games that I hadn't played for some time. I thought I should kind of refresh my memory. That included Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. And I'd played Wind Waker a couple of times because I really love that game, but I, you know, spent a little bit of time with that too. And it was just a really great, great time. God, I love those games. They're just such terrific games. But it does seem to me, and Twilight Princess kind of sealed this idea for me in my head, I think the series needs to move forward. And I think it requires some rethinking on a kind of fundamental basis from Nintendo about kind of what they want to do, what they want to preserve as kind of the core experience of that game, and then what they need to do in terms of innovation to breathe some new life back into that series. And I don't mean to suggest by any means that I think Twilight Princess was some kind of a disaster. It's still a terrific game. And I just, you know, I love all of them. So I'm obviously objectivity is probably a little bit of a problem for me. I'm kind of a sucker for the whole series, but it does seem to me that we ought to be able to generate some new ideas. And the purpose of my series of posts was to do that. And oh my God, the response that I got from people, from so many of you who decided to throw in this or that idea. You know, in some cases, people wrote paragraphs of suggestions and some in defense of the series, you know, not change this or not change that. But most of them had to do with, you know, really substantive, pivotal design choices that could really alter the way that franchise is working and where it might go in the future. And you know, I just had a great, great time with that. So a lot of time this week was spent on the Zelda games. Now, on my next podcast, because I don't have time in this one to do it, I'm going to kind of collate all this into the big, perfect future Zelda game as it should be. And it's going to be a series of my ideas combined with ideas that emerged from all these conversations that I had with some of you who came to the blog. And you know, my hope there is that that we can wrap up with a series of specific recommendations. What kinds of things need to be in the next game? What kind of things need to be tossed, perhaps? And what the experience of playing the next Zelda game should be like? Some design ideas from the point of view of players who really care about the franchise. So that'll be a whole segment on the next podcast. I think you'll enjoy it if you're into the Zelda games. I think I'll either make you really mad or I'll at least interest you. That's the hope. At least interest you. So that was, you know, a big part of the game playing week. I also spent a bit of time with Patapon. It's the portable game for the PSP. A terrific little game. I posted on that, and you can go to the blog and read my thoughts on that. My feeling is that the PSP has suffered from a series of games which may be good games, interesting games, but which don't take advantage of the fact that it's a portable system, that, you know, the games aren't designed with kind of discrete 5 or 10 minute play sessions kind of built into the design of the game so that you can play it, have a real good time, and then turn it off and come back and play another segment later. That, you know, too often it's kind of been a portable version of the PS2. And since they, you know, can roughly play the same kind of games, the hardware, I think, unfortunately, designers have thought of the PSP as just an extension of the PS2. And that's unfortunate, but Patapon doesn't make those mistakes at all. It's a terrific portable game. It's also great for, if you like rhythm games, rhythm music games, and I do, you'll have a great time with it. It's a perfect little game. I've also been playing MLB 08, the show, for the PS3. I finally got my own PS3 that I can play in my house. And, you know, I held off for a long time because, you know, the games weren't there. And I'm sure a lot of you have held off buying that hardware. And maybe you still haven't quite committed to doing it. But, you know, a couple of games really kind of pushed me over the edge. I'm a huge baseball video game fan, and I really wanted to play MLB 08, the show, and I'm just loving it. It's a terrific game. And if you've tried the new MLB 2K8, the 2K Sports game, it's just night and day. I mean, that game is nowhere. It's not even in the same league as MLB 08. And so if, you know, I would almost say MLB 08 is worth the purchase of a PS3. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but it's the road to the show mode, which is basically turning a baseball game into a full-fledged RPG, is worth the price of the game. And I would say almost worth the price of the hardware. Finally, I've been spending just a little bit of time with StarCraft. StarCraft, the old PC RTS. And I'm doing it with a purpose. I have a feeling that the story of that game, the kind of underrated narrative of that game, has some pretty interesting connections to kind of the world we're living in right now. And, you know, that game is really about something. It's not just a fast-paced real-time strategy game, although, of course, it is maybe the best one ever. But there is, in fact, a pretty ambitious narrative attached to that game. And I just see a lot of resonance in what that story is telling us, what those characters are about, and what they believe in. And I think that might be a game we ought to pay attention to again. So those are a few of the games I've been playing. And Super Smash Brothers, I forgot. Yes, Super Smash Brothers Brawl, of course, I've been playing that too. My wife and I actually have been playing our way through the Subspace Emissary Adventure mode, and God, if you're a Nintendo fan, I mean, any past history at all with those games, that adventure mode just serves up nostalgia on a platter. I mean, it's just one nostalgic reference after another with music and little references and little offhand bits of humor that are funnier if you've played the games, and the kinds of idiosyncratic meetings between characters from different games that would never make sense together in any other way, you know, joining up and fighting the forces of Wario and Bowser or whoever they're going to fight, and pulling it all together for the sake of keeping hope alive, you know, whatever. Whatever it's about. You know, frankly, I haven't been able to make much sense of the narrative in Subspace Emissary, but I don't really care. It's just a lot of co-op fun. And this whole notion of a bridge game, you know, which Nintendo's really into now, it's a way that you can take hardcore gamers and casual gamers and make games that can kind of bridge those experiences and give the hardcore gamer a lot of fun, a lot of rewarding fun that would be connected to the kinds of gameplay he or she wants to have, and then throw in a casual game element or a co-op element that will enable a person who's less serious about games to also have fun. And that's really kind of the perfect description of my wife and me. And so, you know, we did it with Super Mario Galaxy. We're doing it now with Super Smash Brothers Brawl, and I'm loving it. She's loving it. And, all is well with the world. I want to mention a couple of blogs that I think you'll enjoy. And the first one is one that you've probably already heard of. It's N. Guy Kroll's Level Up blog over on Newsweek. Now, N. Guy probably doesn't need me publicizing his blog. He's a very notable guy, and you can catch him sometimes over on the 1UP show. He's a guest there sometimes. A panelist on that podcast, and you know, he'll pop up at any number of other places where they like to talk to journalists who think hard about games. N. Guy gave me a couple in the same week, linked to a couple of my stories, one on the Zelda series and one on Patapon. And when that sort of thing happens, you just have no idea what traffic looks like on your blog. I mean, you know, I get a pretty decent amount of traffic. Certainly it grows every week, and I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, when Newsweek comes along and N. Guy Kroll says, hey, here's a link you might be interested in, kaboom. I mean, you get hammered in the best possible way. And so, you know, I'm grateful for his interest. And if you're listening, N. Guy, I want to thank you for the traffic, but I also want to thank you for your interest and for your support of my work. Yours is, of course, terrific, and I would think so, even if you didn't link to my blog, because I've been reading it for some time, and I'm an avid reader. So best of luck to you, continued good luck, N. Guy, and thank you for your support. The other two bloggers, somewhat less notable than Engai, sort of more in my league of game bloggers. One of them, this is interesting, you know, I before I do my podcast, I'll put up a post that says, hey, if you'd like for me to mention your blog, or if you have something you'd like to, you know, publicize, send it my way. And if I think my listeners would be interested, I will mention it. And, you know, that means that I don't always mention all of them that I get. Sometimes I'll get an email from a blogger who's just started a blog, and, you know, they're doing kind of nice reviews of games, kind of thumbs up, thumbs down or whatever. And I think in some cases, these are, you know, like high school students or, you know, college students who are starting their first blog. And I'm not necessarily, it's difficult for me to kind of put them front and center on my blog or in the podcast as something you need to see, because if I do that, then I sort of become, you know, kind of a clearinghouse shill for any blog that comes at me. And I don't want to do that. I want to always recommend ones that I think are useful and that the people who read my blog and that listen to my podcast, that they would probably enjoy something that would connect. You know, if you like The Brainy Gamer, you'll probably like this blog, for instance, or that podcast. And what was funny this week is that I got two from two wonderful guys, and I love their work, and they were asking me to publicize their blog. And, you know, I'm subscribers already to both of them, that neither of them had to alert me to the existence of their blogs, because I read them, I read every post they write, and I'm a big fan. And so these are very easy recommendations for me to make. The first is called Magical Wasteland, and it's written by a fellow named Matthew, he works at an independent developer, and he is writing really interesting pieces. There's one I want to mention to you, and I hope you'll pop over there and check. It's called In Defense of the Meaningless Video Game. I think it's dated like the 28th of February, and I'll put a link up on the show notes, but he was at the Game Developers Conference, and he noticed that everyone seems to be agreeing that video games just don't mean enough now, that they aren't being taken seriously because they aren't ambitious enough in terms of their, you know, kind of self-importance or what they're supposed to be about. And he has a real interesting take on that. I won't give away what he says, because it's much better for you to read his words than my little thumbnail sketch, but you should head over there and check it out, and you should subscribe to Magical Wasteland. He has an admiration for games and a love for them, but his eyes are wide open. And so he writes from the perspective of someone who has a bit of experience in the business and who understands that not everything that comes out and calls itself a video game is necessarily going to be worth your time. He writes about writing. He writes about you know, bad writing in games, good writing in games, the banality of writing in games, and various other things. He's a very erudite guy who has a real interesting kind of individual, clear-sighted take on video games. And I would strongly encourage that you head over there and check out Magical Wasteland. The other one is a brand new blog by a friend of mine who's become a friend via us being sort of blog brothers, is a guy by the name of Dan Bruno, and his new blog called Cruz Elroy. And those of you who go back a bit of a ways to the arcade era will know what that Cruz Elroy reference means. I'll give you a little hint. It has something to do with little Pac-Men and ghosts. Anyway, this blog is devoted to intelligent conversation about games, very similar to mine. And I want to recommend a post that he wrote that really relates to my Zelda series. I'm interested in music, and one of the posts that I made on the series has to do with music in the games and Koji Kondo's contribution to that series and how really underrated it is. But I don't really have the musical chops to do kind of musical theory stuff. I can read music and I get it to some degree, but Dan actually does have good musical chops and is able to, in an analytical way, take a look at what Kondo's up to musically. And he's focused on what he calls Kondo's kind of harmonic palette. And trust me, this isn't, you know, you don't have to know anything about music to enjoy the post. He gives you some nice little MP3 files to click on and listen to. And he looks at, a certain kind of musical progression and a way that there's a kind of signature sound that Kondo develops that you can hear that's traceable through his work, and he kind of proves that to you. It's just a really cool, really smart piece of writing that takes seriously the kinds of music that we've loved in video games for a long time, but, you know, I would contend we haven't really taken the time to seriously analyze or appreciate as we should. And, you know, in the case of Koji Kondo, I mean, my God, the work he's done for Nintendo, those franchises, you know, the kind of the musical signature, but also the sonic signature. I mean, he's well known as the guy who wrote this theme or that theme, but he also designed the sounds. So the little bleeps and blips and familiar signature sounds of the Mario games, that's also his stuff. And it'd be hard to imagine those games without that contribution. So Dan Bruno, the name of the blog is Cruz Elroy. I'll put the link in the show notes. Head on over there, subscribe to the blog. I think you'll enjoy his work. I certainly do very much. Now, I have a bit of business that I want to clean up from the last podcast. I promised to answer a question from my friend Dan Fisher, who is a Buddhist chaplain, and he understands that I practice Buddhist meditation, and he does as well, and he knows that I'm interested in this thing I call meditative gaming, which, you know, I'm sort of constructing this. There isn't necessarily a series of games that are designed with meditative practice in mind, but I do think that there's a way you can think of a certain kind of gaming that you can do, which has meditative qualities. Dan sent me a question in the form of an MP3 file, and it's related to meditative gaming. So I'll play that for you, and then I'll answer his question, or I'll try to anyway.
Hey, Michael, it's Dano. I have a question for you about meditative gaming. In all of the blogging and podcasting you've done recently, I'm hearing a lot about the view of meditation, that it's not particularly goal-oriented, that it's about the cultivation of attention and awareness, and, you know, you can recognize these things in certain of the games that you've referenced at the blog. What I don't see so much is sort of a conversation about all that's happening when you're playing a video game versus maybe the way meditation is designed to bring your attention to one thing, you know, typically the breath in beginning meditation. It just seems to me like there's an awful lot going on when you play a video game versus when you're meditating. And I'm curious to hear you say a bit about that, because this is something I don't know a lot about, so it may seem obvious to you how the interface between the player and the game is meditative, but it isn't so much to me, so I'm curious to hear you say a bit about that. Thanks.
Okay, well, first of all, Dan, thanks a lot for the question, and I really appreciate the MP3 file. It's a really nice way to get the question into the podcast and let people hear your own voice, which I think is nice, and anybody else that would like to do that, I'd love to have your questions in MP3 file form. So, obviously, games are designed typically as rule-based systems. They emphasize competition and completion of objectives and high scores, and there's a competitive element to them. So there's a winner and there's a loser, typically, and we play them, you know, to overcome obstacles or to meet challenges. That's the typical way of playing a game. But it doesn't have to be like that. And, you know, you can take a game that isn't necessarily designed for meditative play, and you can approach them in such a way as to provoke a kind of meditative state, or at least a way of focusing your attention and cultivating a state of concentration and even mindfulness. Oftentimes, this has to do with a kind of a repetitive thing. And I know some have written about games like the Harvest Moon series, where the game insists that you do a series of tasks that are very repetitive, planting and harvesting things. And, you know, you just sort of do the same thing over and over. And if you're not thinking of it in the way that I'm describing it, you know, these could be just seen as a chore and not terribly fun for your average gamer. But if you're able to focus on the effort, on the repeated effort of planting, digging a hole, putting the seed, you know, move to the next spot, dig, plant the seed, you know, and you just do this over and over, and you do it very carefully, mindfully watching yourself do it, and then, you know, kind of focusing your mind on that task in such a way that enables you to notice when things come up in your mind that need your attention, right, or that demand your attention. And that's, of course, the process of learning what's going on in your mind, learning what's really happening inside. And, you know, for me, if I'm doing these things and my mind suddenly wanders to, you know, I'm worried about money, or I'm worried about my child, or I'm worried about do people like me or whatever, you know, these things that naturally rise up through this process can be terribly instructive to me, and I can let them go through the process of sort of recognizing that it's there, acknowledging its existence, and then sort of saying goodbye to that and continuing with my planting of seeds and digging of holes. Now, believe me, I figure that there's a huge percentage of the listener, the listening audience that has no connection to what I'm talking about and sees it probably as a kind of a silly waste of time. And maybe it is. I mean, I'm not necessarily willing to say that this is the way one ought to play games. I just suggest that for me, there is a way that that it impacts me and that focusing my concentration and my mindfulness on these kinds of repetitive tasks can be useful. And part of it is, I would say, connected more to what you might describe as walking meditation as opposed to sitting meditation. And that may be the key difference that, as you're probably aware, Dan, you know, walking meditation involves being very conscious about specific physical actions that you're taking and how you're doing those and focusing your mind on the very, very simple process of lifting one's foot and placing it down and paying attention to the whole sensory experience there. I would suggest that if you're manipulating a mouse or you have a controller in your hand and you're doing very simple things, that there are some analogs there to what walking meditation is like for a person who is interested in that and finds that more useful, perhaps, than sitting meditation. I also think that the game you're working on and that you want to try to render this experience into or out of matters. That, you know, you can't just take any old game, because sometimes you get sensory overloaded, I think, by some games. And some games are very frenetic, or they require you to do certain things that really, I think, maybe work against the idea of peaceful meditation. But, you know, I have heard a kind of an opposite argument there, and I don't have firsthand experience with it, but people say, you know, you play a game like Ikaruga, for example, a really fast-paced, hardcore game where you've got to just completely get in the zone in your mind and just everything around you has to disappear and you're totally, totally zeroed in to that experience. And that some people have said that has a kind of meditative quality. I don't quite see that. It seems to me there's a difference between a shooter in basketball being in the zone or a golfer being in the zone and the meditative process. They aren't the same to me. But I do see some connections, and I can easily see where a person could find him or herself so zeroed in to the experience of gaming that they've kind of, you know, isolated themselves from the world around them, and that there is something very useful about that experience, very absorbing, and in a way kind of detaches you from the world that you live in typically, and that kind of escape can be attractive. I wouldn't necessarily say that is anything like meditation, but there are maybe some connections. So I mentioned a game called Aquaria, which I think does have the kind of properties in terms of its gameplay that is conducive to meditative gaming. I would also mention another game called Endless Ocean. I mentioned the Harvest Moon series. Some people have even said Animal Crossing. These are games that work in a certain way that may lend themselves to this process. But, you know, having said all this, I don't mean to suggest that everyone needs to agree with me, or that this is, you know, that I'm right about this. I think I'm kind of constructing this notion in a certain way. Others have talked about it too, so I think I'm not the only one, but it has had some meaning for me. I don't know if I've been able to explain it well, but that's my best shot, Dan, and I hope that's helpful. I'm very happy to welcome Lee Alexander to the podcast. Lee is a writer for Gama Sutra, and she's also editor of Worlds in Motion. She does a column over at Game Set Watch, which is called The Aberrant Gamer, which I want to talk to you about. And she's done a lot of writing for a lot of different publications, including Paste and Variety and The Escapist. So you're the hardest working woman in show business, Lee, clearly.
I think so, maybe. I don't know. Well, congratulations on all of the great work you've done. And I want to welcome you to the podcast. And I have to say, because I'm going to let you do most of the talking, but I have to say, I don't know if you've ever done this. Have you ever like Googled yourself, your own blog? Because, you know, you've written so much that you can actually, so I can't figure out what I wrote. So you Google something.
Yeah, sometimes actually, if I'm in the middle of something and I say, oh, you know, this ties back into something I was just talking about. I don't use Google though. My blog has a keyword search, but I do sometimes forget everything I said, yeah. Honestly.
You know, the reason I did this whole search is I was searching for you on to just sort of see, well, what have I written about her? And, you know, it's embarrassing the number of times I've referenced you and linked to your pieces. And I have evidence that you are truly my blogger hero, because I referred to you as my blogger hero months ago on the
blog. You did, and I saw that, and I was extremely flattered.
So I'm not just buttering you up now that I have you on the podcast. It's an absolute fact.
Thank you. I think that, you know, blogs like yours and mine are sort of uncommon in the way that, you know, a lot of people wonder, you know, have you ever had anybody say to you, and this is like a real question, you know, why do you think so much about this? You know, like, why do you write so much? Why, you know, why do you think the games warrant this kind of intellectualism? Yeah. And I just, you know, people do say that to me, and I'm like, you know, that doesn't really compute for me. So I definitely think that your blog and my blog are neighbor blogs, in that we sometimes kind of maybe afford things more intellectualism, if you will, than people are usually accustomed to. And they, you know, maybe think we're crazy, but I don't know.
I know you're right. And where I work, there are a fair number of my colleagues that this is such a mystical thing I'm doing to them. I mean, they have no idea what in the world I'm writing about or anything. You were very encouraging to me at the beginning, partly, you know, you were personally encouraging to me by, you know, giving me a little link and mentioning my blog. But more importantly, you know, I was looking at your blog and kind of thinking of it as a model for what a blog could be if you were really seriously focused on video games. And I mean, your writing, of course, is terrific, but it was the community that had surrounded your blog and continues to
my
be a big part of your blog.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's what really encouraged me.
I'm really, really fortunate. My readers have really restored my faith in gamer humanity. You know, one of the things that's actually challenging about game writing, and, you know, I write in, you know, for a few different kind of subsects of the audience, and the response is always a little bit different depending on who it's focused on. But one of the things that can be challenging for a writer about games is that it's such an opinionated and demanding audience. I kind of disagree that the 14 to 17 male is the, you know, core of the market anymore. But, you know, that's certainly, you know, tends to be, you know, one of the more vocal, you know, maybe that's not the entire audience, but they're the ones who are most inclined to leave comments. You know, one of the things I had to learn is you really have to stop worrying about if you're pleasing anyone. And secondly is, you know, I realized how sort of lucky I was and how much of a pleasant surprise that the discussions that take place on my blog turned out to be, because I don't know what I was expecting from the people I was writing for, but the people who read Sexy Video Gamerland regularly and comment just far in a way exceed my expectations. So, you know, I'm very fortunate.
Well, it's amazing. There's a lot of serious critical thinking that goes behind some of the posts that are made on your blog. And I'm lucky I'm getting some of that as well. I get a fair amount of it on a regular basis. And I just think, you know, these people are devoted to thinking hard about video games, and they want to be part of a conversation. And, you know, Sexy Video Gameland is, it's really a kind of an open forum for such people to have their say.
That's what I try to encourage, because I think that maybe the business side of the game industry still doesn't understand its audience very well. And maybe, you know, maybe the game audience doesn't understand itself very well, because there are, you know, I'm having a discussion going on my blog right now about, you know, labels to put on gamers, what kind of gamers there are, you know, and I think that there's this, you know, common misconception that there aren't people who want that level of critical examination, who aren't that people who want that kind of critical community. There's still, you know, even in people who market and sell and make games, a bit of a misconception that gamers are people who just want to swap memes around and look at boobs, you know, and that's totally not true. So, you know, when I was saying that your blog and my blog are sort of neighbors, I think that we sort of share that kind of value in providing something for that audience, which, you know, people thought didn't exist, but which absolutely does, and, you know, wants a place to go and read game stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk just a little bit about how you got started, and you've written a little bit about your background, your training in theater. You have formal conservatory training as an actor, and that doesn't often translate into a video game journalist. So
no.
I'm kind of curious how you leaped from where you started to where you are now, and what in your background led you to kind of where you are in writing about video games.
Well, it was kind of a big leap, I do have to say, but in one of the articles that I have written for The Escapist, and there's a link in the sidebar of my blog to my archive of Escapist stuff if anybody's interested in reading it. It's an article I wrote called Growing Up Gamer that was all about my relationship with my dad, who was a technology journalist all through my childhood. And he high-level editorial positions, I think, at magazines like Computer World. He did the home technology column in the Boston Globe. We were from Massachusetts, so he was kind of like the tech guy. He would be on TV sometimes. And back then, video games were still a sort of, very small, niche product that was still considered, it would go on the shelf beside VCRs. It was a more of a general tech product. And the idea of consumer technology was still so new that, oh my God, you can have computers in your home. That was at the time that my dad was writing, the idea of they didn't have this gadget culture. It was just beginning. So, my dad, he wrote a lot. He before I was born, he wrote about VCRs and his VHS and Beta battle was our HD DVD Blu-ray, So he wrote a lot about that stuff and then started writing a lot about games, not consumer game journalism, because really such a thing didn't start existing in my awareness until I was about 5 or 6 years old. But he would review sometimes or write about consoles often enough that we were getting, PR packages of video games in the mail all the time. Now, I was a lucky brat because every kid on my block wanted to come to my house. I was very, very fortunate to have that exposure early on. My dad really encouraged me to learn to use a computer, right away. To him, the idea that parents are trying to, restrict their children from being curious about the possibilities of technology is really foreign. Granted, they didn't have the internet, but my first experiences were playing, PC games for kids on a Commodore 64. And I could type when I was like 4 years old. I got a real, real big head start thanks to the things I was surrounded with and, my father's encouragement. I used to play computer games and I remember, I was little, and I was reading early. So, like real little, I could have been like 4 or 5 years old when I was like left alone in our computer room with an entire wealth of unopened packages of games that had come from PR people. It was such a playground.
Wow.
I can remember, we had a finished basement. It was like the entire floor of our home, carpeted. We had like a Macintosh Quadra down there and we had an Apple IIe and a Commodore 64 and an Atari. And I can remember, he would just kind of, when the packages came, he would just kind of toss them in the closet. And I would go and open up the closet and stand there and look at all of the spines of all of the retail boxes. And to me, it was really like I would get a prickle on the back of my neck. It was like each one was promising me like a new adventure.
Wow.
It was really just, such a playground for dreams. And I think that's when I first really learned about the possibility of games to really engage the imagination.
Yeah.
I used to play, text adventure games or, sometimes like text adventure games with like really, really crude, jaggy graphics. And they would just become my life. Like I would tell my friends about them and bring them over to play them with me. And then we'd go outside and play that we were still, spies in Kabul, and these were not games for kids that I was playing. So they weren't inappropriate or anything, but they were, they were complicated, really meaty affairs that required a lot of critical thinking. And, I didn't always get it or do very well at them, but, I really credit that with a lot of engaging my mind with what games could make possible.
Those are amazing games too. I mean, those are such amazing games.
I still have a text adventure interpreter on my computer. I really recommend Gargoyle. And then you go to the archives of the interactive fiction competition through the years and just download everything because it's so much. And I like the ones that are old school and blippy and full of bugs. Like I used to sit there and provoke syntax errors and think I was talking to the computer. Like that. I mean, that's how I grew up, really. And so that was how I grew up with games. I had all the consoles really, pretty much, and became hooked on various types of experiences from an early age. And then as far as the writing side, my father was very successful journalist in his field. He wrote 2 books on computer viruses, when they were still like, oh my goodness, what is this? And how to protect your computer before we even knew about, spam and Trojan horses. Like I remember him, you know, he'd try to tell the family what he was working on around the dinner table and trying to explain, you know, what a, you know, Trojan horse is or what the Michelangelo virus is. And, you know, the rest of the family, like, thought he was making it up. So,
now, did you read your father's writing? I mean, even as a kid, was that anything that you were interested
no,
in?
No.
Yeah, because I find that interesting. The kids don't, you know, like, you hear this a lot with people who are, you know, even famous writers. Their kids completely ignore their work growing up.
No, I never read his books. My father, maybe even three books. I know two for sure, both on computer security, and then maybe a third one about... I don't know, but I don't even know. And no, I didn't. And you know, because I was so small that I would just flip open the newspaper and see his picture and go, "Cool, that's my dad." But you know, I didn't care to read what he wrote. But he really kind of instilled in me he's a real stickler for language. My father is a real, real stickler, and he never treated me intellectually like a child. You know, I really actually think that's good advice for all parents. You know, of course, you need to understand that your kids are children from an emotional standpoint, but intellectually, my father spoke to me as any other adult, and you know, I feel like I've pretty much always had this vocabulary and my, you know, my acuity for writing because of my father. It's something I grew up with. Yeah. I never didn't know how to communicate well or how to write because of him.
And what, so, I mean, what a gift that is too. And you think about what a parent can do for a child. That is an amazingly positive gift.
Absolutely precious. You know, it's the best thing my parents. You know, one of the best things my parents ever did to me was not to make assumptions about my intellectual interests based on my age. They did not, you know, and I've said before, I think very, very, very years old, it didn't mess me up, you know. Yeah. If I had questions about things, I would talk to my family, you know. I had like a boundless intellectual playground. They left me to their own devices. You know, today I see, you know, parents with their kids and they're pretty much telling them what to make in the sandbox. That was, you know, that was the opposite of my upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, was a really gift on the part of my parents, because all my life I enjoyed communicating through writing. I scanned recently on Sexy Video Game Land this Phantasy Star 2 book that I wrote when I was in fourth grade. I decided to go to school and make a whole book and draw pictures but that's just an example of how energized I was, how much I was piqued by games and you know, how much they really just, you know, triggered my imagination. That was how I, you know, really enjoyed kind of escaping. You know, I had a really overactive imagination. So, you know, that was very helpful for me. I think it was great that I had games. But I never thought of becoming a journalist. You know, this maybe sounds a little bit arrogant to say, but when I was in high school, I felt like, well, being a writer would be enormously easy for me. You know, that's my fallback. You know, I always know I can become a writer, so I'm gonna pursue something else.
Right.
And theater was something else I'd done since a very young age and been in plays since I was like 4 or 5 years old. I was in a strange movie when I was a little girl. I'm not going to tell anyone about it because I don't want anyone Googling it. My mother took me to commercial auditions. I did a lot of community theater plays. I had a lot of really great roles, and that was my passion, you know, growing up. That was really the thing that I considered, you know, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to be a famous actress. I'm going to be as beautiful as this actress. I'm going to be as famous as that actress. You know, I really just wanted to make it big and be a big star, be a great actress. And so, like you probably read in my column, when I went to acting school, I kind of, you know, had the awakening that, well, you know, I mean, I'm not saying I wasn't a good actress, but, you know, I really had to, I was really behind as far as understanding it as a craft that took discipline. You know, I really just thought I was going to show up in a room and be great and get
right.
famous.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's not to say that I don't think I'm good at acting and that I didn't get a lot out of my education. I did. And I actually, you know, I hope that maybe I will be in the audition line outside of a cool stage theater someday and give it another try. But I'd certainly maybe like to kind of combine my two loves and be in television journalism one day.
That struck me too. You wrote about, I'm you know, picking up sort of what you said a second ago, but you wrote a piece which really struck me as interesting about kind of how games communicate truthfulness to us, using a kind of framework for understanding that comes from your training as an actor, where, you
right.
know, believe me, I mean, I was having horrible flashbacks to moments that were very, very powerful to me. That those moments when your teacher just destroys you, you know, sort of destroys you with a purpose. I mean, it's not necessarily 100% mean-spirited, although I do think sometimes there's a little bit of that in
well,
there.
They got to be tough because we were a little bunch of prima donnas.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we were all the best in our small town,
yeah,
and we
exactly.
thought that everyone was going to just hand it to us. We really did.
But there's this brutal honesty about performance, about characterization, about, you know, truth. And, you know, you sort of want to say to a video game designer, try for that, buddy. You know, like, make me believe that. This is such a lie.
Completely. It's a very painful and emotionally challenging level of honesty. And I'd say, you know, of all of the kids, you know, my conservatory program was very small and it was very exclusive. I think they got like 2,000 applications and took, you know, 200, you know, and then the second year we were cut again. And so of all of us that actually graduated, you know, some 75 of us, I would estimate, graduated. And maybe two or three of them, I've seen them in, you know, very mainstream, very cheesy commercials, but the rest of them, as far as I know, are not doing it much. You know, that's not a fact. You know, they could be, and I just haven't seen it. But I actually think that so many of us, and, you know, possibly even myself, were diverted from acting as a career because of the serious degree of having your shit together emotionally that it requires.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard work. It's painful stuff. You have to, you know, in acting school, we're all having to, like, go back to, you know, our painful childhood memories or our painful high school years and draw upon the things that have hurt us to create, you know, sincere pain when that's required, you know, so that it's not crocodile tears.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very challenging. It takes a lot of emotional stamina. And I don't know necessarily that I was ready for that. I know that I felt that I wanted to grow up a little bit more first.
And the one problem with having to go through that, if you happen to have anything else going on in your life, you know,
yeah.
even just a little slightest setback, you know, it can
when
just,
I did,
it's so
I,
much
I did.
To
I was. I was dealing with some other issues at the time that made it really, yeah, challenging and overwhelming,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
If people read my work, they know that maybe getting to the point more briefly is something that I'm really working on as a writer. So you see, I just ramble on a lot. So after acting school, I had been with my boyfriend for a really long time. We've been sharing our apartment with roommates, and pretty much my priority one was to help us move out and get a place for just him and me. And in New York City, that's kind of no mean feat because the rents are very, very high. So the first thing I did was I got a job at the quickest and easiest thing that I could make money doing. No, not porn. It was being an administrative secretary. I went to a financial management company and you know, was an administrative assistant. That's something I had done like as summer jobs in high school, because even then the computer skills that my father gave me, you know, let me make a really good salary right out of school,
yeah, right.
you know, because I had, you know, uncommon, you know, I was like 100 word a minute typer. I was, you know, very savvy on the internet, and people, you know, people in the business world really appreciated that. And so, you know, my colleagues, you know, I mean, my friends, when I was in school, they would go and, you know, take normal jobs at the Starbucks or whatever. And I went to offices and, you know, did temp work. So that's what I did right out of school. I went and got a job at a financial management company being a secretary, and oh my God, you know, the things that I learned about business are, you know, probably a subject for a whole nother podcast. But basically, I hated that. I did that, you know, from 2004 until really like 2007. I just, you know, did a string of jobs that I either would get fired from because I would lose my motivation and be lazy and I would just be reading game blogs all day and get fired, or I would just, you know, I would get to the point where I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning, and I would be like, you know, we had this dreadful, dreadful blackout in the summer, one summer in New York. I think it was the summer of 2004, and the lights were off for 3 days and there was no running water, and I lived on the 24th floor of an apartment, and I was happy as a pig in shit because there was no work. Like, it was a brutal, brutal time in the dead of summer with no power, and I was so happy. I wanted the lights never to come back on. So that was my first cue that I was, you know, maybe in the wrong line of work. So
yeah,
anyway,
I
moved out, you know, my boyfriend and I got a place, and finally, you know, one day I walked away from this job I had, and I just couldn't freaking do it anymore. And I began thinking about, what would the life I really, really want to have look like? And what I imagined was pretty much the life that I have now. And it was kind of a real lucky streak from, you know, from there to here. Because I started out, you know, I was, you know, reading Gamasutra and, you know, reading Kotaku and looking around and saying, you know, how did these people get into this? So I just asked them. You know, I started emailing everybody who's worked that I liked and saying, I like what you do. How do you do this? Why do you do this? How can I do this? And I'm really, actually, you know, the fact that you call me a model for your work is really, really flattering, because, you know, I wouldn't be where I am without people who served as a model for mine. I emailed Chris Dahlin, and he's the blogger of Save the Robot, and
Right.
He also he does a Gameset Watch column now, and he wrote for Pitchfork for quite a long time. He's really a mixed media journalist and very talented. So I started emailing with him and asking him, you know, sort of, can you look at what I've written? Can you give me some feedback? And he actually was kind enough to give me the opportunity to start doing some reviews for Paste. And the first time I wrote a review for Paste, it was a review of Elite Beat Agents. And the first time I saw my name in print, I was like, oh my God, I love this. You know, I want to keep doing this. So I started the blog, and sometimes I go back to my very first posts on Sexy Video Game Land, and I look at, you know, how much I hadn't quite discovered a voice for myself yet, and how I was kind of, you know, copying everything I saw out there. And it was really early on, had nothing to really differentiate it from another blog. But what was important was that I committed to doing it every day. I was unemployed. I was collecting unemployment, I think. And I was just, I said, all you have to do is do this every day. Everything, every word you write is a step on the way to your goals. And that's what I thought, you know. So that, I mean, I'm sure that anybody who's not written for public consumption before would have the same, you know, issue in sort of the whole finding your voice process. But after I felt a little bit more confident with it, I started noticing that I was getting more traffic, you know, to all my articles about hentai games than I did about any other article, because there's really kind of a dearth of intelligent writing about them, and they're really freaking fascinating little social capsules about Japanese culture, or, and, you know, and they tell things about us when we find out about what we like, and they're, you know, they're kind of embarrassing, and they can be really tacky affairs, and people don't really like to talk about it. But, you know, there was a whole subculture that I was familiar with, you know, that, and you know, that was always another motivation for me, was the whole idea of subcultures, because, you know, I was always, you know, I was kind of like a real geek in high school, and I wasn't, you know, going to football games or anything. I would, you know, when the internet was new, I was like in message boards and in AOL chat rooms and discovering all these other people like me who kind of lived in this like virtual underground. And that really, you know, I really, you know, felt a sense of affinity with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I got my first hentai game from somebody that I only knew from IMs, who we were just ripping illegal torrents and, you know, talking about these games. And I said, you know, what's the problem with speaking openly about this? And, you know, I have something to say about this. So I started doing that. And when I noticed that, you know, I liked what I had to say about it, and that it was getting some, you know, a little bit of attention, you know, although the blog hadn't grown at that point to the point that it has now, I decided, you know, I again, continuing my tradition of turning to, you know, asking people to mentor me, essentially, I bugged Simon, who runs Gameset Watch, and I said, I have this idea for a column, you know, will you let me write this column? And he, I guess, you know, he was like, yeah, absolutely, go for it. Because, you know, another thing that I've learned, especially since, you know, having a more significant editorial role, you know, in my work with Gamma Sutra, I know that editors, they want you to, you know, people wonder how to break into writing, and they say, you know, how will I ever be good enough for someone to want to publish me? Editors want to publish you. Editors would love to hear good ideas. You know, we're mostly like working under the gun. It's very competitive. We're desperate for really good original content. If you have something to say, you should really just ask somebody to give you a shot, because they want that. They, you know, they want to. Editors would love new writers to share their ideas. They, you know, they would absolutely. You know, I was telling you, Michael, I really think that you should pitch a Gameset Watch column. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've thought about it, and it's, part of it is a time issue for me. Part of it is, you know,
yeah,
this kind of double life that I lead, and, you know, trying to
it's
figure
true.
Out what I can manage. Now, you're one thing I was sort of curious about your perspective on. You, I mean, you're a good example to me of someone who started as a blogger, and of course you're still a blogger, but you really, especially in and the way people think about this word, have become more of a journalist.
Yeah, I hope so.
As you're, I'm wondering if your perspective has changed in any ways as you've gotten kind of closer to the industry. I know that you have a lot more access to people who are making games, and you're invited to events, and, you know, there's a whole kind of transition that's happened for you. Has that changed your perspective or your thinking about video games?
It definitely has. Now, the transition has really kind of snuck up on me. I have never wanted to call myself an industry person, because I think the industry people are the ones who are actually making the games. When pressed, I'll say, you know, my work is in the games industry, but I still consider myself one of the consumers. And that's something that's always, you know, been important to me, because even, you know, once I started working at Gamma Sutra and writing for Worlds in Motion, I could have stopped blogging. I could have stopped pitching other outlets. I was making my living. You know, I had kind of, you know, achieved it, so to speak, that I was, you know, working from home and being full-time a games writer. So I could have stopped the rest of the stuff, but Gamma Sutra is an industry magazine, and it was really important to me, because so much of the motivation of my for my work came from, you know, being part of a a shared consumer experience. And being a games consumer is the source of so much of my inspiration. So, I mean, yes, it has definitely educated me more, but I sort of try to strike the balance and not get too myopic. My focus is still how the consumer is going to ultimately receive something.
Right.
But I really actually think that people who write games consumer stuff should, I mean, I think it's so preferable, and I've been so fortunate to be at Gutmasutra, it's so preferable to have some kind of background in industry and to learn about, to learn about it as a business. That's sort of helped a lot with my perspective on emerging trends. And then when I learn something about, what the industry is doing business-wise, I can sort of tie that back to what consumers do and how consumers feel and see whether that correlates or does not correlate. So it's definitely informed me to a useful degree, even though, my priority and my desire has been to be a consumer writer. And, as I told you before the podcast, I have a semi-secret announcement that I'll be making on the blog probably sometime next week regarding my next step on my pursuit to that goal.
Yes, that will be exciting. So definitely we'll need to keep our eyes open for that. Just a couple of the quick little things. I promised I wouldn't keep you too long.
That's fine.
You mentioned, how it feels and what happens to you as you get a little closer to the industry. And it really isn't, for me anyway, my recent experience at GDC, I talked about it on the last podcast and I've written about it. It really isn't like the old sausage factory cliche, It actually is fun to go behind the scenes and talk to the people making the games. They aren't mean. They aren't ugly. It isn't horrible. It's actually a lot of fun to talk to them, to go see where they work, to watch them do what they do. And this may sound silly, but I mean, it energizes me a lot more writing about video games when I have such a respect and admiration for the people who really are the ones making the sausage.
It's so true. Yeah, no, it's so true. Like there's, I often write about how passionate at least the most vocal portion of the audience is and what a response they can have when a company makes a decision they don't like, or when a company like EA is so huge, people make automatic moral associations about it. But it's really an untrue representation. One of the things that I have learned is that almost everybody I talk to has been cool. Like they've been people like us, And of all the negative things I learned working in finance and in business, this is something I learned there too. There's this American cultural perception that, big business is evil, that the men in suits are bad. But if you go inside any of those companies, each one of those people is someone just like you who's just trying to do their job the way that they were assigned to do it and trying to, find something to love about what they do. And the thing that's great about people who work in games is that, just like game journalism, game development is such a tough career to get into. It requires so much qualifications. The odds are stacked against the individual, trying to break in because it's, so steep a slope to achieve. And you have to work very, very, very hard, and not for zillions and zillions of dollars usually if you're in game development. So it's challenging. So one of the, and that's actually really helped, getting to go to GDC or getting to speak to people on the phone. When I approach games critically now, I have a greater sense that, I have a greater sense of the integrity of the effort behind it. It's really not that a bunch of people in suits cranked it out to try to manipulate you. I mean, there are a lot of, I think, maybe questionable decisions going on in, how games are, the green lighting process for games or, what the goal of a game is. But, even then, that's not the company's fault. That has to do with their investors and how they have to make certain sales requirements. So, it's a very tricky dance,
yeah.
But ultimately, no, it absolutely isn't a sausage factory. If you go to any trade event or if you speak to anybody who works in the industry, one of the things I try to remember every day when I write about something or when I review something is, A, real people make these games, and number two, nobody ever tried to make a bad game, and nobody ever tried to take a shortcut, and nobody ever just slapped something together and didn't care. If a game is low in quality, they may have had other obstacles, in development, like not enough budget or not enough people, or, the project may not have been well organized, but everybody behind it probably cared a hell of a lot about what they were doing.
I'll just mention this quickly because I thought you'd get a kick out of it. I wrote a piece some time back about Fable 2 and these developer diaries that they keep releasing, these videos.
Yeah.
And I was a little they pissed me off a little bit because they sort of claim in the way they sell them to you that it's just a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the game. And, we just kind of had a camera sitting here and we picked it up. And
right.
And it's, it's obviously marketing. And most people get that. It's all in-house marketing. And I just, you know, I wrote a piece that I thought it was a little deceptive and they ought to be a little more honest about it. Well, I got this really nice email from the PR director of that game. And he took it in stride, you know, and he kind of, it was a funny message. So we had a nice email chat and that was that. The other day, he sent me a little email saying, well, we're coming out with the next developer video. And I just wanted you to know that I cut back on some of the slick camera angles and I made the lighting look not so slick. And I think you might like it more.
Well, you know, that's one thing that, you know, I think that a lot of times game developers take the rap for game PR. In my experience, I found that a lot of people who are, and this is not everybody, you know, I'm not blaming everybody, but a lot of the people who are working in public relations around games don't understand the audience maybe as well as they should, and they don't understand, you know, the influencer, who the influencers are as well as they should, you know, to some extent. To another extent, they understand it very well. They understand now the power that forums and blogs and communities and things that aren't necessarily professional outlets, they understand that those things can have some. I've spoken to friends who run, you know, fan sites or enthusiast sites, and they're just, you know, they don't make any money off of it. They just do it for fun, and they've got maybe a quarter of the reader base that Sexy Video Game Land does, but they have an easier time getting, you know, free games and press access than I do, because they understand that a lot of times those things happen at the grassroots, you know? So they're very clever about how they do this. And, you know, they were very clever in recognizing, you know, you know, when they saw, you know, your criticism and, you know, going to douse that fire. At the same time, though, you know, it does read as manipulative. There's a lot of manipulative PR, but I think that, you know, consumers just kind of need to keep their heads on straight and, you know, not blame the game and not blame the game companies and understand that they're being marketed to, and that if there are, for example, miscommunications out of Sony, that it doesn't mean the PlayStation's not a good product. You know what I mean? Things like that.
Right, right. Well, I want to ask you one last question, and this is a question that I ask each of the people I interview. Mitch Carpata, who your old schoolmate. Do you remember?
Yeah, we went to high school together. Yeah, of course. It was so funny. I didn't know that he was also writing for Pace until I picked up an issue, because I was in it, of course. And I went and I flipped to the game section. I was like, that can't be the same Mitch Carpata. And so I just kind of like stashed it in the back of my mind. But then, you know, the more I started looking at Mitch's work, I'm like, oh my gosh, I do know Mitch. And we come from a very, very small town, Michael. Like,
That's what he told me.
I mean, it's such a crazy coincidence. There were like 200 kids in our school. There were, you know, 8,000 people in our town. It was very, very small. You know, there were fewer people in my town than there are, you know, in my whole borough now where I, you know, my whole neighborhood now where I live. So it's such a funny coincidence that we're kind of like adjacent to each other in the blogger world, because we had such a small class.
Well, I like his, you know, I like insult sword fighting a lot, and we became blogger friends, and so he was my first interviewee, and so we started this little tradition that I ask each of the people that I interview, and it has to do with what the game would be that you would choose if it was to be the last game you ever got to play. I call it the Last Supper game.
So if I was going to die tomorrow,
yeah, that's right. If we can avoid the morbid side of the question, it's not a desert island game, because I think most people would choose a game that would, you know, perpetually
last long, like, yeah,
a,
yeah, right, exactly.
Right. So this is your kind of last gaming experience, and I'm wondering if you have one, and just a brief explanation as to why that might be your choice.
Huh? Yeah, that's really kind of a tough one.
Yeah, it is tough.
That's really tough, but I'm just going to go with the first thing that comes to mind. And this is like a really cheesy story, I'm going to warn you. My ex-boyfriend is now like my best friend in the whole world. And we still live together for the time being. I'm moving out in a month, but we're really close friends. And we still play games together, you know, even though we're not in the same relationship anymore. And we met when we were 17 years old because of both being into Final Fantasy VII. We were younger than that. I was like 15 when I first like signed on AOL and started meeting, you know, I'm not sure what age I was, but I was young. And so I would go on AOL and go in this chat room about Final Fantasy VII. And I met him there, and he lived in North Carolina and I lived in Massachusetts. And we would like play that game like 9 million times over and over and over again and talk about it. It was sort of like our first gaming bonding activity was Final Fantasy. And, We became real, real sentimental about it. We like shared fan art. We're like, you know, we're very emotional teenagers. But, you know, and then even though that was, you know, like 10 years ago, we just got our pre-orders of Crisis Core, and we're totally geeked out because it's like 10 years later and this franchise is still strong. You know, I know there's a lot of controversy about whether Final Fantasy VII is or isn't a good game. I think it is a fucking good game, but I'm sorry if I curse.
That's all right.
I got very heated. You have to bleep it. But yeah, so I just have so much fond sentimentality and emotional association around that game, just hearing the theme music and, you know, playing the little familiar areas. So if I only had one more game to play, I would probably want to have Joe over and have us play Final Fantasy VII together one more time.
You know, I think a lot of people would. The college that I teach at, it's a small liberal arts college, it's an all-male school. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we're like one of only two private colleges left in the country that are all male. And yeah, it's very interesting. You'll have to come visit us sometime. It's
I would
quite
love
a place.
To.
I teach this video game course, and you know, you might expect this. This might not come as such a surprise to you, but you know, a lot of the guys that I teach, and I ask them what would be their game, what game means the most to them. A lot of them say Final Fantasy VII.
You know, and it's so funny because it's a game that gets a lot of bad rap now, and everybody laughs at it because it's so, like, I don't know, emo or whatever, but I think that people don't want to admit that was the first game that made them cry because
right.
It seems so primitive in retrospect, and it seems so easy in retrospect, you know, easy in terms of how easily it produced an emotional reaction. But it really, I remember that was the first time that I was as excited about a game release as you'd be about like a Star Wars film coming out. We saw the trailers, like we saw it advertised in television commercials, and the trailers made it look like it was the first time it was a real like media experience to
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the way they really prepped it and unveiled it. And I loved of course, the Japanese animation. And, you know, I still have my full page like color pullout that I got probably from Game Informer. I don't remember which game magazine it was, but there was a full page art of Final Fantasy VII that I pulled it out, and I was doodling pictures of it in the margin in school before it even came out. Like, I was so excited, you know, and I hadn't played a game like that before. I mean, there were the earlier Final Fantasies, but they still sort of followed the kind of traditional grind format of the old RPG. But this was the first one that really said, hey, you know what, we're going to make story really important in a game.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will dispute with me on that and say that there were plenty of other games that did that, but Final Fantasy VII was definitely the most visible and the biggest kind of cultural phenomenon that we had yet seen at that point.
Yeah. Does it matter to you if they, do you want them to remake it? Do you want them to make a real souped up, nice PS3 version of it?
Oh, yeah, actually. And this is kind of, I mean, most game journalists would be more like reticent. Critical of something like that, but I am so on board with a remake, and I admit it's because I'm completely biased and sentimental.
Sure.
You know, and you know, I'm not even going to stand and say that Final Fantasy VII is the best game of all time, and that the criticisms that people now levy against it are wrong. I mean, absolutely, I laugh at myself because for being, you know, a big fangirl, but you know, I would love to see it remade because actually, I think that's one of the things that like Mario Galaxy really had going for it. When I played that, and I'm realizing that I'm playing, you know. I was probably like 7 when I first played Mario, and here I am playing Mario again, and it's in like this glorious full color 3D, and the game mechanic has been completely reinvented. And that was just like a really special moment for me with like when I first saw like the opening sequences of Mario Galaxy.
Oh,
I just
absolutely.
Had this moment of, oh my God, look how far we've come. And I would just love to have that moment over Final Fantasy VII. I just got my Crisis Core pre-order in the mail today. Amazon was late. And, so I can't wait to pick it up and hear the old music again and geek out like a fangirl.
Excellent. Well, we know what you'll be doing this weekend then.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. Well, I'm very grateful, Lee, for your time and for your willingness to talk to me. And I've really enjoyed the conversation. And
no
I want to wish you all the best luck with your work on Sexy Video Game Land. And I want to encourage everyone to head over there soon, I imagine, for the big news,
yeah.
Your big announcement.
Yeah, I think I'll post it like next Friday, a week from today.
Great.
Yeah. So
all right.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
This was fun. I really appreciated it.
All right. Well, you take care, and I hope we can talk again soon.
You as well. I absolutely love your blog. It's one of my favorites. I'll have to check out your latest work soon.
Thank you. Thanks, Lee.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Brainy Gamer podcast. I want to thank all of you for joining me. I want to thank Lee Alexander for being my guest for this episode. I want to thank Dan Fisher for the MP3 file. And to those of you that listen to the podcast on a regular basis, I want to thank you especially. And if you have a chance to go over to iTunes and do a little feedback on the podcast, I think I have one feedback listed. It was posted back in December, and I sure could use a bit more feedback. I think it helps get people's attention when they're searching for podcasts. If a few people have commented on the podcast, and if you have anything positive to say, I hope that you'll head over there. If you have something negative to say, I hope that you won't. anyway, no, if you decide you have something bad to say, post it. You know, it's an open forum. But anyway, some feedback over on iTunes would be great if you have the chance. So, thank you all for listening to the Brainy Gamer podcast. See you next time.